This is the current federal tax developments for the week of April the 1st, 2024. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPA. This week, we're going to look at the following issues that have arisen in the areas of federal taxes. We're going to start by looking at the tax court reversing its position on the validity of regulation that relates to conservation easements that it had upheld as being valid 4 years ago in another published tax court decision. We'll talk about what's changed since then and the not quite clear answer to what happens in the Sixth Circuit. Next, we're going to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments this week in a case involving the estate tax value of a corporation that received life insurance to redeem the majority shareholders' estate's interest in the company. Now, we had talked about Conley when it was first decided. That was upheld on appeal. That case is then appealed to the Supreme Court. We're going to talk about this week what we heard in the oral arguments that have been given. Obviously, we expect a decision on the case before the end of this year's term for the court. Finally, we'll discuss an IRS news release on activities of the Criminal Investigation Division regarding their investigations and convictions in COVID relief cases. For the most part, the cases we're going to discuss there are PPP and EIDL loan cases, or what they're specifically discussing, although I'm sure the implication they're giving is to suggest that this might expand into ERC issues. Let's start with the tax court reversing itself. This was the case of Valley Park Ranch LLC et al. Versus Commissioner. Case 162 TC number 6, a published decision issued on March the 28th. Now, as you know, published decisions are officially the position of the tax court. And generally, the tax court means if the same facts come before the court in a new case, the tax court will follow the same rule of law as they do in this case, unless the Circuit Court of Appeals in the circuit in question has ruled in a contrary fashion, in which case then they would follow that circuit's ruling according to the Golson rule. Now, what's happening here was this issue involved a question related to the use of proceeds of a judicial extinguishment of a conservation easement. The idea being, you know, if we're giving a conservation easement that otherwise qualifies, it would be disqualified if it's not done in perpetuity. Now, because always things could happen, like there could be an eminent domain proceeding that would allow, let's say, the local county to take over the entire area and disregard any of these easements that were on the property. I mean, they pay for them, supposedly, but otherwise they're extinguished. The question becomes, what happens if that property is sold and therefore the easements are extinguished by a judicial act? How do we divide up those proceeds? And the IRS had issued regulations that outline exactly how it's to be done. And there's been a lot of controversy there about certain rules. You know, in a case a couple of years back, the issue involved the question of whether or not if there were improvements made to the property, because the general regulation says that you're to allocate the proceeds received from the property in the ratio that the easement had to the overall value of the property when it was gifted. And the problem with that was if the holder of the property, because remember, we just gave an easement, if that party improved the property, added value to the property as a whole, but obviously they didn't do anything that violated the easement, so the easement stayed pretty much as it was, is that okay to take out of the equation? We had a case where the tax court said, no, the reg says you're to allocate based on that original contribution. And of course, there's been lots of questions about whether that regulation as written, you know, was valid. There are some questions involved. And specifically, the questions are going to revolve around whether the IRS properly followed the Administrative Procedures Act. Now, in the case of Oak Brook Land Holdings, LLC versus Commissioner, 2020 case, 150C TC 180, it had held that the regulations were valid and that they had not violated the Administrative Procedures Act when the regulations were adopted. This case was sustained. It was appealed by the taxpayer. It was sustained on appeal by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court, in essence, turned down the taxpayer's request to take this case up. So now we're at this point. Now, interestingly, before the Sixth Circuit heard, I'll get that out right, the Oak Brook case, the 11th Circuit, in the case of Hewitt versus Commissioner, 21F4-136, and the actual discussions on page 135, had held in an 11th Circuit case in 2021 that the IRS had violated the Administrative Procedures Act. So essentially, Oak Brook came out of the tax court as a published decision first. Then later, Hewitt, which was an appeal of a later tax court memorandum decision that was, as I recall, issued about the same time as Oak Brook and followed Oak Brook. The 11th Circuit then said, nope, the reg was wrong. It didn't follow the APA. Therefore, to the extent that this was reliant upon the regulation to invalidate it, then, you know, the tax court was wrong. And then after that happened, then the Sixth Circuit upheld the Oakmark decision. So now the catch was, we're going back. How's the tax court going to react to having been overturned in one circuit? Now, the majority, the IRS, the tax court will rule that, in fact, the IRS violated the Administrative Procedures Act, and therefore the regulation is invalid. And if the only reason that this easement fails to be a qualified conservation easement is because it doesn't follow that regulation, and presumably the court finds that it does follow the general intent of the law, even if it didn't follow that specific view of the law, that, you know, the taxpayer wins. And what they argued was, you know, now the problem here, of course, is obviously they're going against their own opinion, which on paper was sustained by another circuit. So, you know, why would they go and say, well, this 11th Circuit says no, the Sixth Circuit said yes, and it would seem it'd be a bit messy at that point. Well, what the majority argued and what makes this interesting regarding how it's going to work in the Sixth Circuit was they determined, reading the Sixth Circuit opinion, that the Sixth Circuit had concluded that there was no need to decide the validity of regulation in the case of Oak Brook because the easement was essentially disallowed for other reasons. So, you know, didn't matter if the reg was valid or not, they couldn't win even if the reg was valid. And the IRS points out that the Solicitor General of the U.S. argued the same point, stating again that you didn't have to see if the reg was valid, Oak Brook would lose anyway. So, you know, the right decision was entered. And so what the tax court has essentially concluded is they came to the right conclusion, but for the wrong reason. So the right result, wrong reason, that was their problem. So what the majority did now then, and it's a split decision, they found that the IRS had not responded to significant comments when the regulation was finalized, which is a requirement of the Administrative Procedures Act, that if they're not going to follow a comment, they're going to reject the comment, and it is significant that the IRS has to give a case for why that comment would be rejected. And they held that the IRS had not responded adequately to the one particular comment, which also had a number of similar comments along the line, and that therefore the regulation was invalid under the Administrative Procedures Act. So to the extent that the IRS was looking to carry this case based on the fact that they didn't follow the regulation, well, that's not enough. The IRS has to show something different because the reg is being held to be invalid. Now, obviously, the concern here is, what about the Sixth Circuit? Under the Golson rule, generally, the tax court will always follow its standard position, except if a circuit court of appeals to which the case would be heard has ruled on the issue in question, they will always follow that circuit's rule, even if the court itself nationwide disagrees with the rule. Given what the majority said and their view on this, it appears the tax court position is going to be that, in fact, they are not violating the Golson rule by following this procedure in the Sixth Circuit. Now, we won't know about that because here's the problem. you can go ahead and you can take that position. Go ahead and let's say secure a win in tax court. The IRS could always go on appeal to the Sixth Circuit, hoping that perhaps the Sixth Circuit says, yeah, we said that, but still we held it was invalid, you know, depending on how you read the case, or it just finds it invalid. So it's going to be kind of iffy there. There is no question in the 11th Circuit, unless the case was to be appealed by the IRS, the Supreme Court, and they took it up, that you're going to be able to ignore that reg in the 11th Circuit. However, always remind people the mere fact you can ignore a reg does not mean you can ignore the law, right? So while the IRS specific interpretation may not be the absolutely correct interpretation because they didn't go through the process correctly, you still have to have a defense of your interpretation, right? You can't just say they didn't come up with one, so this whole area of the law can be ignored. That's not how this works, right? We still need a valid interpretation to back it up. But it does appear there is an opening there in the 11th Circuit. And for now, at least until the IRS would take it up on appeal in the various other circuits, that this is going to be the result you're going to get in tax court as well. So that may make it interesting because obviously the IRS, knowing they'd have to go to the Court of Appeals, we don't know how the IRS expects different circuits to respond to this view of the Administrative Procedures Act. But if they're in one they think that would go along with this theory, and it would based on how they'd ruled in similar cases on viewing the application of the APA, it may be practical matters is, yeah, they're not going to bring their second challenge there. They're going to bring it somewhere else, try to get a circuit split or clarify it is a circuit split, and then take that Supreme Court. Now, as we said already, Oak Brook tried to go to the Supreme Court and was turned down. It's possible the IRS could now, the appeals process is done. I don't believe they could take Hewitt to the Supreme Court any longer. I think that time period has elapsed. 21, it should have. So now it'd be up to the IRS. Do they take Valley Ranch up, to the Court of Appeals, see the decision they get there, and then appeal to the Supreme Court if, in fact, they got kind of a problem. They can't really get a split in the circuits up the Supreme Court. Right. If they win, they don't have standing to appeal. If they lose, then the taxpayer could try to appeal. So, yeah, this could be a little while to figure out this one. Talking about the Supreme Court heard oral arguments this week on an appeal of a case that we had talked about back when it first happened at the district court level. This is the case of Conley versus United States, U.S. Supreme Court, case number 23146. Oral arguments were heard on March the 27th. Now, this case involves life insurance that was paid for by the company, right? The corporation. And it was paid to the corporation on the death majority shareholder. The purpose of this life insurance was, under their plan, they didn't quite execute properly either. There were a lot of weird facts in the case. But anyway, the idea of the life insurance was that it would be used to redeem the shares of the majority shareholder. And a majority shareholder held over 70% of the shares, with the rest of the shares held by his brother. So bottom line, the corporation would take the money, use that to buy the shares from the brother, and then would leave those shares, and then the remaining shareholder would essentially have 100% of the company as it existed before the death of this shareholder without having put more funds in. And that is the way a lot of justices are going to phrase this, which has been taken by a lot of commentators to maybe not be a good sign for the taxpayers in this case. Now, in the regulations, there are ways that buy sells will set values in the case of an estate. But this program failed on a number of structures. Number one, it was between related parties. So it's not as if I talk about a CPA firm like mine, we have three shareholders, all of whom are, unrelated, and we come to some conclusion about that. That will be generally granted market standing as that's a reasonable valuation structure. And those the IRS has not attacked by saying the life insurance has to be considered part of the value. The theory being that, the three of us would come to some sort of agreement. And this assumes, and by the way, this was important here, this was not a cross-purchase agreement. This is a stock redemption agreement. When you're going to buy out the assets of a shareholder, let's say at death, or at other reasons, well, death generally, when we talk about death-funded policy, death-funded buyout with life insurance, you can either do it as a cross-purchase arrangement. So in this case, the 30% shareholder would have a life insurance policy that would be on the other shareholder's life. And when that shareholder dies, will there be an obligation on the part of the other party to redeem his shares? And vice versa, the shareholder with the larger portion would have a life insurance policy on the 30% shareholder and would have an obligation to redeem his shares. Now, in there's no question the life insurance is not a corporate asset. The life insurance does not enter the value of the company. You know, in essence, the taxpayer or the person who's going to get 100% control actually is putting the money in. Now, they're putting the money in by having gotten a death benefit, but remember, they also paid the premiums on that thing, right? So that's how they did it. In a non-cross-purchase arrangement, where it's a redemption, there, generally what happens is the money goes to the corporation, which then redeems the shares. The corporation has paid for the life insurance policy over the years, and it then uses those funds to redeem. And what happens is, obviously, in this case, $3 plus million worth of cash came into the company. And then that $3 point some million of cash was then used to redeem the shares. So in essence, we got a sudden infusion of $3 million of cash into the company, which then went out and redeemed the other shareholder. And, you know, there's no assets that were ever, so nothing changed. How do you value that? And there's been a split in the circuits, and we talked about this when the first case came up, when Conley came up at the district court level, that the 11th Circuit had decided, well, obviously, since it's meant to redeem the shares, the life insurance, you have to recognize the liability in valuing the corporation when you're doing that. Now, the district court, and eventually on appeal, the Circuit Court of Appeals said, no, we're valuing the company in the view of a willing buyer who would get the company's assets. And he would get, you know, the interest of the leaving shareholder, and he would have majority interest and could kill off, eventually waive the redemption. And effectively, you know, so the value of the company would be the entire value, which would be the whatever it's worth before, plus effectively $3 million. Because remember, he's got a controlling interest, so we're not going to get huge discounts except for marketability out of this deal. So there's our hitch. Well, again, we are under the redemption arrangement, and we didn't meet the regulations. So the IRS argued, unlike, you know, the taxpayer argued that the insurance was, you know, the insurance should be offset by liability to redeem the shares when you valued the corporation. Now, it turned out not all the life insurance went to redeem the shares. That's part of what they really didn't follow in the arrangement. They didn't follow the agreement. There's lots of other issues to read this case. But the fundamental question which the court decided was they rejected the 11th Circuit view that you had to consider the redemption obligation when valuing the company in the estate. And it makes, you know, like I said, about a $3 million difference if we ignore the redemption in the value of the estate of the stock. And obviously about 70% of that ends up coming, being taxable in the decedent's estate. That was part of the deal. Now, the 8th Circuit had agreed with the trial court, liability should not be consideration evaluation. And it was at odds with an 11th Circuit decision involving a very similar situation where they said, no, you count that liability. So now we're before the Supreme Court, 1 hour oral arguments like normal, and the justices are peppering the parties with questions. And primarily they peppered the counsel for the taxpayer. Did ask some questions of the government, but basically peppered the questions a lot to the taxpayer. And the Supreme Court had agreed to hear the case, so they heard it. And what seems to really have locked up the justice for a while was, wait, his brother is putting nothing in, right? He's putting nothing in, but he's getting the whole company. The company is still exactly as it was before his brother died. So he's getting a windfall, right? There's an untaxed for a transfer purposes, transfer of value from the estate of his brother to the surviving brother, right? He went from minority owner to 100% owner. with the corporation identical to as it was the day before his brother died, you know, and he never had to put any of his own money in there. And they're saying, well, nope, that appears that in fact, there was you were essentially an indirect beneficiary of the estate. You might not have been named in the estate, but the structure of the arrangement was your brother was essentially transferring a huge chunk of interest to you, you know, in addition. And, you know, so essentially the value of the company should be the much higher number. That'd be included in his brother's estate. Now, the Taxpayers Council did point out that U.S. GAAP requires treating such a redemption requirement and agreement as a liability on the corporate books when such a structure exists. But the justices did not seem interested in looking deeper at this. He did mention that, but the justices really didn't probe deeply into, was it important that GAAP said you do it that way? And I think one of the issues is the justices will see what they say in the decision, but I think we're all aware that GAAP is not valuation. And so there is a difference. Now, you know, and the real concern here is, do you value the 100% of the company, you know, basically assuming it just had this money in there and then go through a redemption? Or do you treat it as the taxpayers arguing, that the liability somehow manifests itself immediately on the books at the same time? And the court may dodge this one too, because yeah, they didn't follow the agreement, so it's not clear what was going on. Now, the taxpayer they spent a little more time discussing this one. They argued the transfer to the brother was only tax deferred at best. Either if he sells the stock, there's going to be a tax on a long-term capital gain, or conversely, if he dies, then we're going to pay tax at his passing, right? It's going to go into his estate. They're saying, so he doesn't totally escape taxation. Although the court seemed aware, as does others, that, well, we just need to find a way to set up a similar structure, you know, when he dies. So whoever, let's say his kids or whatever, we get them in the corporation, put some money in, have them own like 1 or 2%, establish a redemption agreement again, and hey, guys, we can just keep this going forever. That obviously is the type of concern they have, that by using this, you could keep transferring among the family indefinitely by using the life insurance program to essentially make sure that the decedent's family gets a value equal to is affected by in the company, but nobody in the family who's, you know, the succeeding people, the kids, this was brother, but kids could work as well, they would never end up of having their estate or their share of the company. You know, in essence, they would get a massive increase in interest. And so it was one of those issues. Now, it also became very clear on questioning, and this might also be a way for them to decide without deciding. They're wondering why it wasn't arranged as a cross purchase. And unfortunately, here I thought the taxpayers had a not as great an argument. I mean, I think they're arguing that, look, you need to decide this overall, not just this back pattern, and saying, well, you know, if you have a lot of partners or a lot of shareholders, that a cross purchase agreement can become, you know, almost impossible to run, and they are a pain to run. But with only two shareholders, they were each brothers, it's probably a little more difficult to say that it wasn't practical to do a cross purchase. What this does suggest is, you know, they had definitely, at least in oral arguments, opened the door that a cross purchase, and I think it probably is true, a cross purchase would never face this problem. Might want to consider, if you're planning any arrangements here, at least, you know, especially if Connolly comes down in favor of the government, and a lot of observers seem to believe it will now after hearing the oral arguments, should you be arranging for cross purchases if it appears to be a taxable estate? Because a cross purchase eliminates the problem here. Now, the big negative is, of course, the individual shareholders have to pay for the shares, pay for the life insurance policy, and, you know, we have the other problem of making sure everybody keeps payments up to date. Because remember, if I die, my heirs are depending on the fact that the other shareholders, you know, were doing their part and paying on my life insurance policy for them to buy their share of taking over my stock. And if it turns out they didn't and there's not proceeds there, then actually my heirs could be at risk. That's another reason why people tend to like the redemption structure, is you keep your eyes on the payments. So anyway, interesting case. We'll watch for this decision coming up probably this summer. Finally, the IRS issued a news release, IR 2024-83, entitled IRS Criminal Investigation Division Releases Updated COVID Fraud Statistics on Fourth Anniversary of CARES Act, Nearly $9 Billion Investigated. This came out on March the 28th. Now, this is kind of a follow-up to last week's end of the ERC Voluntary Disclosure Program, saying, hey, that's done. Now we're going to talk to you about the fact that we're out here enforcing law, CID. Now, what they tell us is statistically, just under $9 billion in potential fraud has been involved in 1,644 tax and money laundering cases related to COVID-19 relief in some form. And over one half of those cases have been opened in the prior year. Out of all the cases so far, 795 of them to date have, or in well, cases, 795 indictments have come out of these investigations to date. Now, obviously, some of these investigations are just starting. Some of them have been around for a while. But we have 795 indictments. 373 went to trial or have been sentenced to an average of 34 months in federal prison. When the IRS has taken these people to trial, they've had a 98.5% conviction rate. So they've only lost, apparently, on 1.5% of the cases. Have they actually lost the case when they took them to court and not been able to bring back a conviction? Now, a lot of this is because the CID definitely cherry picks their cases, right? They're going for the ones that are obviously, that are going to gain sympathy with the jury. I think I've mentioned before on the program that I've had discussions with people from CID who essentially say, yeah, it needs to look good in front of a jury. It needs to be one that gets a jury mad, because that's how we're going to get a conviction. Right? The jury needs to be mad at them. That's how it comes down. Now, they gave two example cases. Both of these involved SBA loan issues, PPP and EIDL cases. Right? Remember, the PPP loan program was enacted as part of the CARES Act. EIDL was that advance you could get. So those are where the convictions to date have been concentrated on. It makes sense that, in fact, that's probably where most things have happened so far, because that program got seriously underway much earlier. Remember, initially, until the end of 2020, when they passed another act, the original CARES Act, you couldn't get an ERC loan, you couldn't get ERC credit on your payroll taxes unless you hadn't gotten a PPP loan. So essentially, PPP loans are where most people were going. They seem to be a better deal. So PPP loan fraud is what they've been bringing most of things in right now. And the cases are the types they like. What CID loves is finding people that have done clearly fraudulent things. They've established clearly fake companies, right, with fake employees. And, you know, it's obvious none of these exist. You know, one case was a whole bunch of fake companies that appeared to might not have themselves been fake, but they certainly invented like employees and other documentation to back up their claims. And there were a lot of them. The second case was an organization that made their claims went in supposedly for all these not-for-profit organizations that they were receiving the funds for. And again, in both cases, millions of dollars involved, and in both cases, a lot of entities and a lot of applications. So those are sort of things right now that are attracting the attention, not surprisingly. Will we see that change? I don't know. My guess is we're probably not going to see a lot of indictments of one entity operations. I think criminally they're going to want to go after the big splash, knowing that this will scare some people anyway. So that's there. I'm not saying you can't be there. Certainly you do something bad enough. Even if it's just one company, they, you know, if you go out there and you buy the Bentleys, you know, and you claim to have like 50 times more employees than you did, and you claim to have had paid all this payroll you never paid. If it's bad enough, they'll go after a one company structure. But we'll keep our eyes on what's going on. Well, this has been the Current Federal Tax Developments again for, the week of April the 1st, so April Fool's Day, but none of this was April Fool's today. Be sure to check back in the future as we do these. We try to get them done every week. We'll see how it goes the rest of tax season. We try to get them done every week. If you have questions, you can email me, edzollers@currentfedtaxdevelopments.com. I also follow the Connect sites for various state societies, Arizona, New Jersey, Idaho, Illinois, Washington. So if you have questions there, you're a member of one of those societies, you have questions, you can post there. Otherwise, though, we look forward to seeing you back next week. We'll talk about whatever happens new in the area of current federal tax developments.